Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Herman Pretorius. Let's get into our first news story of today. And what we're going to be talking about is an opinion column from Professor William Gumede from the Wits School of Governance, and is a professor of practice and author of Restless Nation, Making Sense of Troubled Times, who has written this absolutely great attack on me and its negative consequences for the for Africa. I'm just going to read extensively from it because it's got lots of good lines in it, but you can see it, I think, on in the Sunday Times, Times Live, I think is where it was originally published. This is Professor Gumede speaking. The enrichment of a small black political elite fostered a culture of corruption using political connectedness rather than merit to generate wealth. South Africa must reset BEE by canceling the current version, which has only enriched a handful of people politically connected to the ANC. The so-called political capitalists never started a genuine business or managed one, and often set up companies simply to secure state contracts or resource shares in the private sector. BEE should be cancelled in state departments and state institutions key to public service delivery, economic growth, and infrastructure development. It should also be cancelled in catalytic economic growth industries in the private sector. Foreign companies that make new investments in South Africa should be excluded from BEE. With 32% unemployment rate, the country desperately needs foreign direct investment. BEE political capitalists also led to the marginalization of genuine black entrepreneurs who are deprived of opportunities in both public and private sectors. It has killed black entrepreneurship. With more than 1 trillion rand in the form of BEE deals since the strategy was formulated in the early 1990s, it has benefited only black political capitalists, white big business, transaction brokers, financiers, and law firms. As an alternative to BEE, local and foreign companies should be asked to provide investments in targeted catalytic economic sectors such as technology and science, mathematics education, low-income housing, critical public infrastructure, small and medium-sized manufacturing enterprises, sport and cultural development. It has nurtured a culture where hard work and entrepreneurship are not valued because all one needs is connectedness to ANC leaders to secure government contracts or BEE shareholdings in private companies. No society can foster economic growth and tackle poverty and unemployment without merit-based culture where hard work and entrepreneurship are valued. It has decimated the productive capacity of South African economy and accelerated de-industrialization. BEE has created more poverty, unemployment, and inequality. It has collapsed both black and white legitimate businesses that are not politically connected and therefore lose out on state contracts or licenses. It has reduced economic growth and state revenue. And it goes on. But Herman, I mean, difficult to say it better, I think. I would perhaps quibble with the levels of investment that businesses should be expected to provide in communities and things, because I think that it's not the job of businesses to provide services. Instead, those businesses should pay taxes to the government, which should then provide some of those services. And also, through the provision of things like jobs and spending and all that kind of stuff in a community, you're going to see upliftment of people, regardless of whether you've built the low-income housing or whatever. But that aside, that is a very minor quibble with what I think is a great attack on this policy, which has failed. And I don't know, your thoughts.
I must agree in full with you. I think that is that there's a bit of that sort of social engineering side of things where you try to put your thumb on the scale of say, right, if you want to participate in the economy, we're going to redirect the resources to benefit the society in a sort of manipulated way. I think that is incorrect because we have examples of that happening and not working well. We have these necessities of mining companies when they start new operations in a new area, then there's this sort of community plan that is by law required, build a school, build a clinic, whatever. And the problem with that is it is quite often imposed on the community without real consideration of what the community actually needs. The community might not need a new clinic, it might need sewage works, or the community might not need a new school, it needs an extension of its police station. Silly things like that left free to the resources of that community, enriched by the investment of job creation might actually come to develop on its own steam. So I fully agree with that. For the rest, I think Professor Gumede says it brilliantly. And what is especially pleasing is that over the last 2 or 3 months, the IRR has been involved or been driving a cost of BEE campaign that has gone through several stages in which we try to quantify the cost of BEE. We've written to parliamentarians, we've written to ministers, we've written to universities, we've written to the compliance sector when it comes to employment equity targets and the like. And we've launched polling that shows by 76.3% to 17.4%, South Africans agree with the following statement. In your opinion, would tax-funded vouchers for schooling, healthcare, and housing be more effective in helping you to get ahead than current affirmative action and BEE policies, which focus on management posts, ownership deals, and preferential tenders? We take that question, we break it down by race groups. 79% of Black South Africans agree that vouchers for schooling, healthcare, and housing would be better than the current empowerment policies. And that sort of makes sense because the empowerment policies as they are currently structured are inherently elitist. You can only really benefit from BEE if you are already at a certain level of economic participation and entrenchment. BEE has never done anything for the township entrepreneur. It is the worst form of trickle-down economics possible. And so I think Professor Gumede is quite right. It's quite satisfying that it comes on the back of several months of issue driving by the IRR. And one of the ministers we did inquire, we did engage with, was Minister Malatsi, who now last week came out and signed this directive for a policy directive to ICASA to adjust from BEE to equity equivalent. Now, equity equivalent still not where we want to be, but moving away from BEE most definitely a step in the right direction. And if we are going to read the balance of forces, that good old terminology of, you know, trying to make sense of which ideas are winning and which ideas are losing, the fact that we are finding this hotspot of BEE interest and rejection by serious people like Gumede, echoing the points made in 2009 by Moletsi Mbeki in his book Architects of Poverty, I think South Africans should take encouragement from this, that we're taking steps in the right direction. Will it change overnight? No. But will it change? Well, if we keep doing what we're doing, if we keep fighting the honest fight, if we have people like Professor Gumede, Moletsi Mbeki still involved in the fight, there's no reason for us not to look back in 5 or 10 years at this moment as the beginning of the end of BEE.
Indeed. I also like that he calls specifically out the sort of highlights the broad categories of people who have benefited from this. He describes them as Black political capitalists, white big business, transaction brokers, financiers, and law firms. And I think that's exactly right. And I think it goes some length to explaining why BEE has been so sticky and difficult to get rid of, and why there's such a full-throated defense of it in the public square when it does get challenged. And, you know, I think the complicity of some big businesses, some of which are, you know, quote unquote white, is definitely part of the story. Part of it is just a desire to, you know, get with the program, knowing what time it is, you know, all those kind of insidious phrases about bending to the sort of political atmosphere. But more specifically, it's because it raises barriers to entry and reduces the opportunity for competition, which is exactly what very big businesses, well-established businesses already like. And then, of course, you've got all of these middlemen, you know, bureaucrats, lawyers, etc., who have basically careers made off entirely of interacting with the situation. And I think that is, you know, been really disastrous for the country's economic condition.
I can't agree more. And that's part of why, from issue driving side, from the IRR side, we've written to these compliance entities and we've asked them some direct questions to which many of them, of course, defer to respond. But, you know, watch this space. We've asked the employment equity consultants whether they have ever or will ever advise a client to fire an employee who refuses to racially self-classify under employment equity targets. We've asked big corporations like Woolworths, how much is your employment equity and your BEE compliance budget? And since 2010, how much have you spent fruitlessly on just making your employment base look the right color, not give better services, not give cheaper products to consumers of all races, but just what has been your investment of your consumers' money into this racial transformation project? Because let's not beat about the bush. All costs at the end of the day get passed on to the consumer. Stuff are made more expensive if the business I'm buying it from needs to spend money on lawyers and race audits. That cost doesn't disappear into thin air. It goes into the pockets of the beneficiaries of the system, and it comes out of the pockets of the consumer, mine, yours. And I think we can tie it almost to a fight I'm sort of currently having a bit in the Afrikaans media, is against big agribusiness, where they sort of have this really placatory, passive approach to expropriation without compensation, going back to the constitutional amendment, where if you can set up the regulatory environment and the legal environment for your sector to be such that new entrants can't get a foothold, can't get the assets they need to, in the case of BEE, expend more capital than they have at the beginning to make sure that they are racially and, you know, according to the targets, constructed in the right way, then you can keep competitors out of the market. You can, expropriate market share without compensation and make sure you keep your sectoral role. So we should keep a very keen eye on these interests that want BEE in place, not necessarily for ideological reasons, but just for good old market access. And you see this in economy after economy, from West Germany to today. If the big corporates get in bed with big government and they get big labor on their side, they can rig an economy to make it impossible for any real competition to come in. And BEE is part of the South African milkshake of that particular toxicity.
All right. Speaking of the pushback that we expect from the sort of entrenched parties, MK has threatened that it will take Minister Malatsi to court if the Starlink Gazette is not scrapped, the thing you just mentioned there about making it easier for foreign internet providers to have access to the South African economy. Nkonto Sizwe's MP Colleen Makabule, who came to political prominence as the Speaker of Joburg as the single member for COPE, who then switched from the DA-led coalition to the ANC-led coalition, then left COPE to form her own party called the Rainbow Alliance and appears to have now ended up in MK, has put out a statement saying that this regulatory change by Minister Malatsi threatens to undermine transformation, and that if it moves forward in the current form, MK will be sure to challenge it legally in the courts. Herman, what do you make of this?
Well, I would welcome a challenge like that because I don't envy MK their argument. Let's assume this goes all the way to the Constitutional Court. Who is willing to fight the argument thus? Yes, this thing we are opposing might create jobs for South Africa. Yes, there is broad agreement that job creation in South African economic growth is the number one priority that needs to be unleashed for better lives, a tide of upliftment to lead to better lives across the board. Yes, the racial basis on which we operate is flimsy in law at best, and possibly irrational if we are to take the good old administrative law argument. Yes, all of these things are true, and yet we would rather keep in place a failing system than admit the failing system has failed and open the door to something else. Because let's be clear, Minister Malatsi's move from BEE basis to equity equivalence is not a massive shift. BEE is about the transference of share ownership at the top level of your company. Equity equivalence is not about share equivalence. It is much more about profit allocation and revenue allocation, still mandated, still race-based, still quite at the whim of the state. So there is some difference. We can see it as a step in the right direction, but certainly not a stride or a leap or a lunge or a jump. It's a step in the right direction. So if such a modest change is opposed brutally, that's a good sign, because it just means that, number one, the balance of forces, if the IRR's campaign, IRR polling, Professor Gumede's opinions are anything to go by, the balance of forces does seem ripe for a victory on the side of pragmatism. But also, it's just a very difficult case to make that if you're on the side of BEE, you'll need to point to successes. And the only successes you'll be able to point to is the fulfillment of arbitrary targets. And if one justice on the Constitutional Court says, yes, but let's park those targets for a moment, why is black unemployment today worse than it was before BEE started? Then we've got a clincher. Then whether the court sides with one way or the other, if that clip gets played in South Africa, then we've got a win. Because then it's clear that the failure metrics speak so much louder than any possible conceivable arbitrary success metric. So good luck, MK. I hope you take it all the way to the Constitutional Court, because you're going to have to argue that a rigged, failed system is the one you want to stick to.
That's exactly correct. Now, let's move on to our last story. I think there was a... Yeah, it's an opinion piece by Stephen Crotus, which is titled Violent Crime and South Africa's Long-Running Sore Exposed in Trump Meeting. And this was the spectacle that McCorner and I last week, when commenting on the meeting between Ramaphosa and Trump and the White House, made a comment on, which was that the South African delegation there spent an enormous amount of time trying to convince Donald Trump that no, it wasn't that we were specifically just murdering our white farmers. It's that everyone was being murdered at a shockingly high rate. And we've had the latest crime statistics, which show, thankfully, that murder is slightly down. But it is still very grim. Between January 2025 and March 2025, so just the first quarter of this year, the number of people murdered in the country was 5,727. Which in the same period last year, it's down, was 6,289, so significant drop. You know, a lot of the normal patterns that we see in our crime, Gauteng, KZN, Western Cape, I think the Western Cape being at the top of the murder list, although I haven't double-checked that, but that's traditionally where it's been. Those three provinces seeing the majority of our murders. And then also the Eastern Cape having a disproportionately high rate of murder. One of the more interesting stats that I think is slightly under-discussed is the associated reasons for murders. About sort of a fifth of them, arguments, misunderstandings, road rage, and provocation was the top cause for murder. About 1,137 of the murders was committed because of that. Retaliation, revenge, and punishment was second, with about 400 murders attributed to that. And 323 people were killed related to robberies. The Minister of Police, Minister Machunu, said that that every crime that is reported in South Africa is recorded and accounted for by the South African Police Service, whether it occurs in an urban area or the most remote and rural areas. I think the fact that he's having to say that is perhaps a sign that this is not a widely held belief. But, Herman, you know, there's something very distressing in our crime stats. There's two, and I don't know what the figures are for this quarter, but... often the number of vigilante killings are quite significant, there being a couple hundred. And then the fact that arguments, misunderstandings, road rage are such an enormous percentage of our murders. You know, often this is people under the influence of alcohol or drugs, just murdering each other. And I think it says something about the kind of, firstly, the general social dysfunction that you see across a lot of South Africa, but also the sort of, there's almost like a kind of a pressure cooker vibe to South African society. And unfortunately, it gets expressed in this terrible violence against each other. What's your take on this?
Yes, it is indicative of a society that has no trust in the conflict resolution mechanisms that we usually associate with modern society. Mob killings, retaliation, arguments, these are what one could almost call adolescent forms of justice. They aren't thought through. They are very passionate. They are emotive. And they aren't really anything that could recognizably be sold as reasonable justice. So what I read from these numbers, also from the mob killings point, is that there's a real, the fact that Minister Mchunu had to say, you know, every crime gets recorded from the most rural to the most urban, is this almost a quiet acknowledgement that trust has been fundamentally lost, that we don't even, not even, don't we don't trust the crime numbers, never mind the mechanisms and the systems that by rights should keep those numbers down or in check. It is a reflection of how we have almost fallen into a national depression with fits of anger, outbursts of anger societally, because we simply just don't see other forms of redress happening for us. Our options are limited in terms of internally what we can hope to see happen with justice. So it is, to my mind, on the one hand, incredibly distressing, but there is a silver lining here, and that is that the factors that lead to this sort of behavior really stems from, do you have a society convinced that it has a secure place of existence, or people within it have a secure place of existence? Do they see aspiration as realistic? Do they see hope as motivational? Do they see the balance of criminality versus non-criminality as economically the better option to restrain yourself? Those things are problems of socioeconomics that can be fixed, I think, within a generation or two. It won't be easy, but I think we can see green shoots if we get to a point of rediscovering what socioeconomic aspiration really feels like, that people don't have to think, you know, I'm abandoned by the system, I'm abandoned by society. If they can start feeling empowered with just some socioeconomic upward mobility, I think we can trigger a cascade of positive psychological consequences that can bring these numbers down, not eradicate them, but just start seeing them move in the right direction. Of course, each individual case a tragedy, but if we're going to look at our country and hope for solutions, we're going to have to think longer term than the politicians who think in electoral terms, the businesses who think in financial terms. It's up to us to take the long-term view, and I'm confident and positive that there are solutions to this sort of problem that could solve this sort of adolescent, irresponsible outbursts of mindless violence.
Indeed. And also, of course, making sure that the police can properly follow up and deal with these crimes would be, you know, just something that I think would just generally lift the mood of so many South Africans who live in constant terror of crime and murder. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we'll see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.